Welcome, everyone, to episode 361 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to talk early takeaways from both of the conference finals series. And my lord, do we have to get into the Los Angeles Clippers after the meltdown they had over the last few games of the conference semifinals. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is a man who is not having a country go through an existential crisis, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
Well, it's going well. We are seeing an uptick in COVID, though, so everyone's doing miserable right now.
Great. All right. 2020 in a nutshell. On the bright side, we have a very special guest today. Now that the Denver Nuggets have advanced into the Western Conference Finals, we thought it was only right to bring back friend of the podcast, TJ McBride. He is a Nuggets beat writer and host of the Rocky Mountain Hoops podcast on Blue Wire. TJ, how's it going, my man?
I'm staying somewhat sane. It has been a chaotic adventure, and I'm not going to lie. I have looked up being an expat and looking my way over to Morton's side of the pond a couple times already. So we'll have to wait and see how the rest of the world kind of shakes out, but we got hoops for now.
Yeah. My wife actually had a genuine conversation with me last night about, you know, she's doing a medical fellowship right now. It could either be 3 or 4 years, and she's like, depending on what happens in November, we might go the short path so we can get out of here sooner.
Yep, I have a buddy moving to Toronto, already set up and ready to go, so I feel all of this. I'm getting ready to try and figure it out myself.
You're
obviously welcome over here, and CJ, you would love it. We have a place called Christiania where you can just get high all day long. You would love it.
Outed. Not that I have ever really been hidden from all of this, but yes, that's fantastic. I am in.
We're all going to be Raptors fans soon enough. But TJ, before we get rolling here, could you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and any work you'd like to plug?
Yes, please go subscribe to the Rocky Mountain Hoops podcast. If you really want to get into my insanity and want to see like video clips at 3 a.m. Mountain Time, you can follow me on Twitter at TJ McBride NBA as well, I guess, if you want that. But the podcast is definitely the cooler one. Go to the Rocky Mountain Hoops podcast.
Yeah, TJ is going to be an invaluable follow, hopefully for the next month, but at least definitely for the next week or two, because his Nuggets are in the Western Conference Finals. TJ, let's start with game one, because it clearly did not go the Nuggets' way. Lakers won 126-114, and it was only made closer by some garbage time garbage time work from the Nuggets. First thing I need to ask you, because this seemed to be the prevailing sentiment, not even on Nuggets Twitter, just Twitter in general, how good were the referees in game one?
I don't think you understand how angry I was. And I am one of the people who actively tries to be like, I don't care about officiating. It's an act of God. I can't control it. I'm letting go of it. It's not something worth worrying about. I was livid all night long at the whistle. And it wasn't just that it was bad or one-sided. The inconsistencies of that whistle was beyond my realm of understanding. They were calling when guys would breathe on somebody the wrong way. They weren't calling when there were clotheslines to avoid fifth fouls. They were calling offensive fouls in the second quarter and like none in the second half. Like the randomness of the whistle made it honestly the worst officiating job that I have seen in my 5+ years covering NBA basketball. I have never seen anything like that. They had, what, 21 free throw attempts in the second quarter? Like, what are you supposed to even do about that? Like, Scott Foster was the MVP of game one of the Western Conference Finals, and I hate that with every fiber of my being.
Yeah, so, I mean, I am tempted to almost throw that aspect of the game away just because it was so inconsistent, and, you know, Jokic got into foul trouble early, which is obviously going to skew what happens with Denver. But officiating aside, what did you see in game one, you know, that concerns you from a Nuggets perspective?
Well, the Lakers just ran. Like, and it wasn't just, we're going to get out and transition off made baskets. They were running off of made layups by the Nuggets. They were running off of made free throws. It didn't matter the circumstance. They were sprinting guys to the corner and one guy to the rim every single possession. And it's funny, everyone kept asking on Twitter, why do the Lakers keep switching? Why are they so willing to let this switch happen? It's because every last drop of their energy that wasn't being used in transition was just being used to switch on the other end. They were sprinting this Nuggets team up and down the court, and it allowed them to dictate the pace of the game. I had Dave DeFore of The Athletic on my show for the Rocky Mountain Hoops podcast, and that was one of the biggest takeaways we had. Whoever dictates the pace of these games is usually going to come away with the victory. And the Nuggets were playing at the Lakers' pace for the majority of Game 1, and I don't know how much they can do to really counteract that. I mean, you can get back as much as you want, but with the way the Lakers are running and with the passers they have to hit ahead, I'm not sure how much damage you can really do to limit them in transition. So in terms of my biggest concern going forward, that is absolutely my biggest concern.
Yeah, I mean, you know, scoring wise from LeBron was not one of his highlight games, only 15 points on 6 of 11 shooting. He did have 12 assists. Rondo had 9 off the bench. Anthony Davis, of course, was phenomenal, 37 points on 12 of 21 shooting. You know, you could hope that it was a somewhat outlier performance from guys like KCP, who was 18 points, 6 of 10, 3 of 5 from 3. But really, I mean, you know, I don't necessarily even think this was the Lakers at their best. It was probably the most dominant we've seen them really in the bubble. But, you know, there's always the 40-point LeBron James triple-double waiting to be uncorked at some point. One thing I also want to ask about is it seemed like they had a pretty good plan for Jokic and Murray in particular, both of whom tormented Murray, especially in the round one against the Jazz. Jokic just absolutely torched the Clippers. What do you think the Nuggets have to do to get those two guys going in particular?
I don't think there was anything wrong with how they were able to play in that game, in my opinion. Because, I mean, when you look at the box score for what they were able to put up, Jokic played 25 minutes, had 21-6-2, and was 8 of 14 from the field. Jamal had 21-1-5 in 29 minutes on 7 of 12 shooting. They were able to get, generally, the looks that they wanted, and they converted many of them. The only issue was the foul trouble. I mean, Jamal Murray also had 4 fouls at the same time as Nikola having 4 fouls. So, it wasn't just the fact that they weren't able to score the way they wanted to. There was some issues there, but they couldn't be physical. That was one of the biggest issues with the officiating last night. That wasn't just it rippled beyond the initial call, because the Nuggets had so much foul trouble. They weren't the more physical team for the second half. They weren't able to be, because if Nikola got that fifth foul, it was over anyway. If Jamal Murray got more fouls, it was over anyway. So I actually don't have an issue with how the Nuggets played offensive basketball last night. There were some lulls that they need to be able to address, but a lot of that, again, comes down to the foul trouble and the way that the game was able to be skewed and the rhythm skewed because guys were shooting free throws and you had to take it out under the rim against a set Lakers defense. Like, nobody's going to be able to score regularly against that kind of a group. So for me, I honestly don't have that many concerns when the game was being played the way it should be played without officiating completely ruining the flow of the game. Denver was fine offensively in this one. So I actually am way more confident than a lot of people are going into game two for the Nuggets perspective. I really feel like they have a lot of things that did work for them. If they can just remotely slow the Lakers by 10% and the officiating just even just gets a little bit more average, they're going to be right there with this Lakers team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're right on in terms of, like, Murray, especially that second quarter was basically all that kept them close for a while. So, the score looks bad, but honestly, it was a pretty close game through halftime. I think, again, the officiating's hopefully going to be the outlier in this, and we don't see, you know, another...
God, I hope not.
Jokic getting in early foul trouble, Murray getting in early foul trouble. I want to ask you, going back to the Clippers series for a second, just because we touched on this when it happened, but I want to get a Nuggets person's perspective, especially. You know, Michael Porter Jr., I think it was after game 4, where he had those comments about, like, we need to play more through, you know, a bunch of different guys, like, not just Jokic and Murray. And then he had the big shot and big block at the end of game 5. You know, in game 1 against the Lakers, he had 14 points on 3 of 9 shooting, 10 rebounds, 4 assists off the bench. Do you think, you know, part of the answer here is just more MPJ, even though with all the defensive concerns that brings?
I think it is, and this is the thing. They played MPJ enough. I don't think this was an issue of, like, matchup concerns or not getting him enough minutes. He played all 12 in the fourth quarter, but that's also a big chunk. He would have gotten 6 minutes to start the fourth quarter, even if it was a one-point game. So Porter got the minutes that I expected him to, and he was able to go score through Kuzma like I thought he could. He has to be able to win that matchup, because off the Nuggets bench, they can get a lot of production attacking Kyle Kuzma in the Monte Morris, Michael Porter Jr. pick and roll when Porter's in at power forward. That is money for Denver. They can score almost every time down. But again, a lot of this was thrown off rhythm-wise because of the foul calls that existed in that second quarter, which was where the bench unit really kind of lost control of this game. So I think Porter will play more. I think we'll see a better Porter. I don't know how much better he'll be defensively. LeBron James and Rajon Rondo are too smart. These are some of the most hyper-intelligent vets you will ever come across. They're going to see Michael Porter Jr. enter the court, and it's going to be like barbecue chicken. We're going to go after that dude every single time. To his credit, he's done a pretty good job, but this is going to be tough for him, and he's going to have to score and rebound enough to be able to make up for whatever he's giving up on the defensive end of the court. But they're going to need him to score, because whenever Jokic or Murray are on the bench, they're going to need Porter to be that guy to kill Kuzma, because Kuzma's not a good enough defender to stay in front of him. And if you put him in a screen, Porter is going to get room to be able to pull up, and they're not going to sell out to Porter. So he kind of has to be that guy to be the X factor to change the dynamics of what is happening on the court and give them some momentum.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because you can always have a hot Gary Harris game or a hot Jeremy Grant game, hot Paul Millsap game, like he had third quarter game 7, I believe. Mm-hmm. But you can't necessarily count on that, whereas I think, like, MPJ, you basically have to say, you know, we need X out of you every game consistently to have a real chance. Like, we can't count on Gary Harris going off for 20, Jeremy Grant going off for 20. We can count, you know, we can pencil you in for 15 points or so. That's at least giving us a nice steady floor.
What's so hard about that, though, is that he has not been asked to do that yet. In the Jazz series, he was not asked to do that. He was free points on top of it. Same with the Clippers series. He is more depended on in this Lakers series than he has been in the playoffs thus far, and I have no idea how that will impact his ability to produce. He's a rookie. We just don't know yet. So that could be a very important distinction here, is that there are expectations on him now if Denver wants to win this series.
Yeah. Mort, any questions about this series before we go?
Oh, yeah, Mort's here. Hi, Mort.
I'm here, too. Yeah, no. No, I mean, just whenever I look at Jeremy Grant, I think he's such an asset defensively. I think offensively there's so much untapped potential. But obviously when you play a game wherein you play 37 minutes and you come out, you know, shooting, what 3 of 10, 3 of 11 or something like that, and ending up with 9 points, I mean, ultimately, that offensive production has to be, you know, delivered in some capacity. If not from him, then someone else. And, you know, Gary Harris wasn't delivering offensively. Paul Millsap was kind of sluggish in that regard. Like, is there a need for that fourth guy, so to speak? Like, if we pencil in Jokic, Murray, and Porter as, you know, reliant players, at least offensively, is there a need for that fourth guy to step up and be a consistent threat?
My thought is this. You need 4 3-pointers in a game from the likes of Torrey Craig, Gary Harris, Jeremy Grant, Paul Millsap. I don't care how it's distributed. I don't care if one dude hits all four, if all four hit one. They need to get some kind of shooting from those spots on the floor, because they didn't get the supplementary help. That was the biggest difference in the first three quarters yesterday, was the fact that KCP played well. Dwight Howard played great in this game. JaVale McGee gave them strangely weird minutes despite the chaos of them. And like Markieff Morris gave them good minutes. When they got the production from those types of guys, and Denver didn't get it from Jeremy Grant, didn't get it from Gary Harris, didn't get it from Paul Millsap, that's what swung this. Denver got enough from their stars. Like, in terms of the Anthony Davis, LeBron James compared to Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray, like, if you put these on a per 36 minute average for what happened last game, they were right there. There was no concern about the star power for Denver there. They needed more from everybody else. They needed the guys Jokic was giving just incredible looks to hit the dang shots, and they weren't doing that. Like, Nikola Jokic was seriously masterful when he wasn't in foul trouble in this game. It's going to be overlooked, but my God, was he controlling everything in that first quarter offensively. If they can just hit those open looks, which they were able to do against the Clippers in those final three games, then Denver has a very real chance here. If they don't, I mean, you're in a running race with a Lakers team that has more talent than you. You can pretty much tie a bow on it. But Denver has to execute when they create those good looks, and they haven't been able to yet.
So I know you were vacillating between Lakers in six and Nuggets in seven before the series. Where did you end up landing, and did game one change your opinion at all?
No. So it didn't change my opinion, and I landed on Nuggets in seven, which is insane to me, because, like, I would have never. I came into this season in October being like, I don't care which Clippers team they play, Denver's not winning. Like, they're cooked. They don't have the horses. They don't have the defense. They don't have the sustainability. They don't have the veterans. Like, it's not happening. And then they went out and demolished that Clippers team. And let's not forget, that Clippers series looked a lot closer than it was. Denver outplayed them in game two entirely. Like, there was not a moment Denver was not outplaying them, and it went to the Clippers' favor. And then on top of that, game one, coming off a seven-game series with just one day in between, they were just beat from the very, very beginning. So in terms of actual basketball where these teams were matched up, Denver outplayed the Clippers more often than people were giving them credit for. So I was in. I trust this Nuggets team to show up now. I feel like there was a true metamorphosis in this team in realizing how good they can be. Last year was kind of a farce. You know, it's very easy to be like, San Antonio wasn't that great. Even Portland, they were fun, but they weren't that great of a team. There's a real argument that Utah this year was better than both of them last year. So to win that series and then to go toe-to-toe with a true championship contender in the Clippers and actually win that series despite all of the adversity that they had faced to get there, I was sold, and I believe in this Nuggets team. I believe they have the ability to adjust. I believe they could have the best player on the floor on any given night with Nikola Jokic at this point, and I believe Jamal Murray has ascended to a different level that gives them that true second star on their roster, and they have the pieces behind them to make it fit. They have the defenders to be able to at least make things somewhat difficult. So in terms of this, the ability to match up with this Lakers team, I believe in this Nuggets team now, and I really do think, even despite game one, that they can push this to seven and win in seven.
I'm with you. I'm just gonna, at this point, I was on the Clippers the entire year from the preseason. Mm-hmm. They were my title pick, and now that they're out, there are four teams left, and I could conceivably make a case for all four of them to win the title this year. It's like super fun in that regard. But I'm out on predictions. I have no idea. So I'm just rooting for madness. I hope it's a Nuggets Heat finals.
Let's go. Yes. I'm in. I need Bam Adebayo versus Nikola Jokic. Two dudes who play the same way and are entirely opposites in terms of how they're built. I love the way this matchup is because they do. They have the killer off the dribble guy in Jimmy Butler and Jamal Murray. You got your high post threat in Bam Adebayo and Nikola Jokic, but you have like this super gritty Miami team and this super finesse Nuggets team. Not soft. They're no longer soft, but finesse. They play on an execution level. They don't just grind out possessions on you necessarily. So I need to see that. That would be the greatest finals in history. I'm in. Give me all the Heat Nuggets games.
I mean, I'll be a little bit bummed if it's Nuggets Heat for one reason. Because when TJ, when you were on this podcast the very, very first time, which I think is about 2 years ago, I said within 3 years, the Nuggets and Bucks are going to meet each other in the finals. And then I'd be just one off. And that would frustrate the ever-living shit.
You would be Bam Adebayo and Jimmy Butler randomly hitting threes away from being correct. And that would just be absolutely hysterical for me. So now I'm rooting for it even more than I originally was.
All right, so let's get into the Clippers now. Because you had a first-hand glimpse at their complete self-immolation. Before we get into what's next for them, what went wrong for this team in that series? Like, how did they go from a 3-1 series lead, holding double-digit leads in games 5, 6, and 7, to completely quitting in the fourth quarter of game 7? Like, that was a complete and total... not even the Sixers could melt down that badly.
When your only option on offense is to say, here Kawhi, here Paul George, and then you have nothing behind it, you are going to have a lot of difficulty getting your way through adversity. I don't know how anybody thought that was a good idea. People kept coming to me and being like, Michael Malone's being outcoached in this Clippers series. And I was like, the heck has Doc done? Doc Rivers said, okay, we're going to go all in on Jamal Murray, and we're going to have Kawhi Leonard. That was his game plan. That's what roasted them. The fact that they went in there with this cocky cocky attitude as if they've ever been to the Western Conference Finals in the history of their franchise, as if they were owed just to have the Nuggets lay down in front of them, doomed them. Like, I don't know who on that team thought, you know what, we're good enough, we can just walk into a Game 7 against a team who just won a 3-1 series when they were behind, and just think that they're going to roll over. They completely overlooked this Nuggets team. And not only that, Doc Rivers was... He's the only remnant of the Clippers team that lost to the Rockets in 3-1 going back a few years. The only one left in the franchise. Doc Rivers stuck with Trez. He played him like 20 minutes in Game 7, and Nikola Jokic eviscerated him. It was not even close. Jamichael Green not getting all of the backup center minutes is a complete travesty. And then beyond that, Marcus Morris out here talking as opposed to playing. Like, the best thing that could have ever happened for the Nuggets was Marcus Morris having that big Game 1. All of a sudden, Marcus Morris was like, oh boy, I'm prime mellow. We're going to start cooking now. And it just all fell apart in their hands. They didn't have the chemistry, which I do believe in. They didn't have the fight because they didn't believe in the Denver Nuggets. And they didn't have the veteran leadership to pull them out of the funk they were in. And the coach, just to make it even worse, continually played his pet player instead of making decisions to actually impact the game. So everything went wrong, and they allowed it to go wrong, and nobody stopped it from going wrong.
Yeah. Well, other than that, though, things went pretty well for them.
Is that enough of a rant? Is that, did I check enough boxes there?
I'm glad you brought up Doc in particular, because, I mean, I think Doc is a good coach, all things considered. And I think
I do, too.
Ego management, I think, is one of the toughest things that – I mean, we can't gauge that most of the time, unless there's a complete meltdown. And I'm guessing he is very good at that aspect of the job behind the scenes. But, I you know, Bud was the scapegoat of the playoffs in the coaching perspective, and for good reason. But I think Doc, as you said, sticking with Trez in particular, who had been struggling really throughout most of the bubble, and especially in this matchup where it's, you know, it's just a bad matchup for him. Had they advanced and gotten to the Lakers, maybe it's a different story. But he was just getting completely cooked every time he stepped on the floor. He had, you know, a couple impact buckets, but like, he was giving up more than he was giving them. So for him to keep going back to that was just like a low key, what are you doing? Like, are you trying to lose this series?
Like, how do you go back to a 6'7" center who can't switch against Nikola Jokic? Like, what on earth? Like, there's nothing logical about that, especially because he wasn't giving you anything offensively. He had, like, I mean, he was getting no rebounds, offensive or defensive. So you can't count on him creating new possessions for you. He was barely scoring at the rim, even when he was in the dunker spot. His hands were stoned when he was getting passes. Like, I don't understand the logic behind, we're going to put a 6'7" center on Nikola Jokic, and we're just going to double him. That was the other thing. There was a double that they sent in the first quarter of Game 7. Paul George waddled over like a penguin as Nikola Jokic stared at it for 6 seconds, being like, I wonder where I'm going to go with the ball. Like, how are you doubling Nikola Jokic like that? How are you going to let him see everything that is happening? There's no way you can win. So it was so lazy. It was so lazy the way that they played that Game 7.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, their defensive communication just seemed totally off. And whether you chalk that up to coaching or to a lack of chemistry, or, you know, there was some talk that that Mark Spears had the report that they were, you know, needed, it was like guys were asking out after only a couple minutes, like their conditioning just wasn't there. It might have been some combination of all three. I don't know, but it looked like they just hadn't played basketball together at all.
But guess what? The Nuggets didn't either, because right. When they got there, Troy Daniels was their only guard. Bol Bol started at small forward. Like, they had literally no ability. They had COVID-19 hit their team so hard, even their coach got it. Like, I don't know what world we're living in where the team that played 7 games before playing the Clippers, the team that only had 8 dudes, 7 of which were centers or power forwards on the team, was suddenly the team that wasn't the one tired, the team that wasn't the one that didn't didn't have the chemistry. Like, how do they make that excuse looking in the face of the Denver Nuggets franchise that actually went through that adversity as well? Like, I'm not discrediting the adversity the Clippers went through. A lot of teams went through that. Nobody was impacted by COVID-19 on a franchise level like the Denver Nuggets were. And that is just a pure fact, and nobody has played more playoff games to this point this postseason as much as the Denver Nuggets have. So to use that excuse is just so beyond my understanding.
Yeah, and not only have they, you know, played 2 7-game series, but they were down 3-1 in both. They were like, they faced six elimination games. Those are high leverage games for them where they have to go all out because they know if they lose, they go home. So yeah, like their stars had to play big minutes, had to come up big time and again. I mean, Jamal Murray in that first round series, you know, was in that ridiculous, amazing, entertaining duel with Donovan Mitchell, and you know, had to come out on top every night. So yeah, the fatigue excuse rang a little hollow, but I would not necessarily chalk that up as a loss to load management, as a certain columnist at The Athletic would. Because, hey, guess what? They didn't play basketball for 4 months. None of these teams played basketball for 4 months. So any advantages or disadvantages that they gained from resting, I mean, I guess you can argue, like, they didn't have time during the regular season to develop the habits and develop the chemistry that they needed in these spots. That might be fair, but I don't necessarily know that.
But even that's a joke. Like, they said all season long, oh, I know we need to get our chemistry right, but we're waiting for the playoffs. Right. How many times did every single player on the Clippers roster say, wait for the playoffs, wait for the playoffs, wait for the playoffs? And it didn't happen. That's on them. And then also, I think it's really interesting that maybe there is something to this chemistry thing, not because of the 4 months away, but because the Clippers were thrown together a year ago all the way through free agency. Maybe there is something to that point, because the Nuggets have been together for 5 years. The Clippers all basically met a year ago. So when you contrast those two things against each other, maybe Denver did have a little better ability to deal with adversity. But again, like, this idea that they didn't have the chemistry because they weren't together in the bubble is insane to me.
Yeah. I'm starting to wonder if, like, the teams that say wait for the playoffs, that hadn't actually gone in advance, like, LeBron gets that because he's done it before, he's won titles, he knows what it takes. But if you're a team that's saying wait for the playoffs, like, that might be a red flag, because the Sixers were doing it all year too. It's like, we're built for the playoffs. It's like, all right, you're the sixth seed. Like, you guys,
I don't know who the exception
suck.
Is this year. Denver said that all season long. They? Wait for the playoffs, as they were losing to Atlanta on the first night of a back-to-back with rest. Like, yes, it was not. It was definitely bullshit, which I find very, very funny.
Okay, so that there are some exceptions to the fraudulent rule. I'm just wondering if this is like a tell that we should keep an eye out for next year.
I'll be watching, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what we really should be taking away from this is just don't trade for Marcus Morris, right?
Yes.
I mean, when you really look at it, I remember when, you know, the rumor mill was going, and there were really two names it came down to. It was Marcus Morris from the Knicks back then, and it was Thaddeus Young of the Bulls. And I was like, okay, I understand that Marcus is more of a shooter, and in today's league, you know, shooting is a premium, yada, yada, yada. But for the Clippers specifically, I thought a guy like Thaddeus Young would just fit so much better, just in terms of the intangibles, the chemistry, the interior play. I think they made a mistake.
That's a monumental mistake. Like, it is so clear to me how much better Thaddeus Young would have been for that team, because they need more versatile defenders. They were literally just trying to guard guys one-on-one or switch with their best defenders and just hope for the best. Mm-hmm. If you went out there and got a guy like Thaddeus Young who can defend literally all five positions, that would have changed everything for them. And on offense, he would have moved the ball. Like, you don't have a black hole that exists down there. He was a very, very intelligent passer for the majority of his career thus far. So I'm with you, man. That's a monumental mistake for them.
So as fun as it is to dance on their corpse, and I think Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum had the best time of all doing that.
God,
we need to look ahead for this team, because they are now entering what is shaping up to be a monumental offseason. I mean, Paul George and Kawhi Leonard are under contract guaranteed next year. Both can become free agents in 2021. And I'm not saying they definitely will, but I mean, the Clippers have to operate with that in the back of their minds. So, you know, they have two big free agents, one of whom is Marcus Morris, the other of whom is Montrezl Harrell. Let's start with Harrell. Do we think he cost himself money in this Nuggets series?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a, of course.
The question is how much, right?
Right. Yeah. But I will note this, though, just to be completely fair to him. He did lose his grandmother. It did seem like there was a psychological component to his regressed play. I mean, he just did not look as, you know, as spry as he used to be. Like, the energy level that we know Montrez to have, you know, that wasn't there. So I have to factor that in somewhat. Otherwise, it would just be completely unfair. But no, he definitely cost himself a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, like, he was on, you know, I'm looking at upcoming free agents this year. He was high on my list of guys who I probably don't want to be paying his next contract. Like, if he's getting 4 years, $80 million, no thanks.
Right.
But what should the Clippers walk-away price be?
It should be the mid-level. Full stop. Wow. Like, there's going to be no money out there anyway. Yeah. Like, this is the thing. What market exists for a backup power forward who can't play center? This was always Kenneth Faried's biggest issue. There's not enough versatility to his role. Even though he can excel in one at an elite level, there isn't enough else he can do to make him create this market for himself to where there's a bidding war for him. So I have no idea how he can expect, with all of the uncertainty money-wise that we are expecting with the cap to come up, to get more than the mid-level. It's the same thing I say for Paul Millsap.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, Brian, you asked me this question like 6 months ago. And I think you and I, we sort of agreed that the walk-up point should be around 14 million, 14 to 15 million. And that was 6 months ago.
Right.
And we also, we kind of reasoned it with, well, you know, maybe that three-pointer is going to come around at some point. Like, maybe he's actually going to pull the trigger on that shot and become more of a guy who can spread the court. You know, none of these things have happened. So at this point, he's just a hustle player who scored from within 10 feet. And as TJ said, there's just not a market for those guys. I mean, hell, I made a whole video on YouTube about how the power forward position is virtually dead in many respects. And especially, you know, the archetype that Harrell is, a guy who can score and not much else. So yeah, I don't think he should be earning double figures at this point. That would seem a little bit brass.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the Clippers' perspective, maybe you chalk this up to a bad matchup and B, more as you said, you know, there's some stuff going on off the court that clearly, I mean, affected his mindset that he was open about. I'm not speculating here. So, you know, maybe next year, like, the guy did win Sixth Man of the Year. He was an impactful player for most.
An award that means jack.
Right, I know, but I agree. Like, he was, what, he still averaged 18-7 this year. It's not like, you know, one bad series, I don't think should cost him, you know, $40 million or anything like that. But I do agree with you guys that there should not be a, you know, again, 4 years, $80 million, run, don't walk away. Like, yeah. And there might be teams out there, TJ, you know, you bring up a fair point of, like, who's out there that's going to be paying all this money. Well, a lot of the teams that have cap space this summer, there aren't many of them, but most of them that do are very bad. And that's the type of team that would overpay a guy like Montrez because they see, well, there's no one really out on the free agent market. Like, we're not going to get Anthony Davis. So if we're trying to make a splash, like, do the Charlotte Hornets try to bring in Montrez Harrell as their big answer, their big free agent answer this offseason.
God, man, that just sounds so bad when you even say it. Like, that, I just don't see how that connects. And also, like, what happens if we remove the Sixth Man of the Year title? Because let's be real, Devonte Graham should have won that award. So what if we removed that title?
You mean MIP for Graham, right?
Yeah, sorry, most improved. My God, I'm so sorry. I mixed that up so badly there. But, like, if he isn't Sixth Man, because he did deserve it this year in the regular season, but, like, that title, like you said, is so – it doesn't bring a whole lot of impact to the table when you come to negotiate. Right. So, like, what does that even change for him when he comes out saying that Sixth Man of the Year, like, that's what I've been able to produce as? Does that even change the conversation in a negotiation arena?
Yeah, and it could work against him. Almost. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it could. I think that it doesn't actually impact the way that people are going to want to bring him on as a new addition to their team, to bring something new out of their roster. I don't think that impacts the way he can come to a negotiation table and be like, I was Sixth Man of the Year. This deserves so much money. I don't think that actually exists.
Or, I mean, it might suggest, like, I was Sixth Man of the Year. I want to be paid as a starter. And other teams are like, no, we're good. We want you in the role that you thrived in. Like, we don't think that you can be a 35-minute game player, starting power forward, because you know you are so limited offensively, and like you can play small ball center, sure, but you know, can you chase around opposing wings on defense? We wouldn't be thrilled about that either. So
yeah exactly. I mean,
it could work against him in multiple facets.
Well, and he's also got, there's a guy in front of him who's better, who needs more minutes, Subach.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, and like we brought up Jamichael Green as well. If you just run it back next to you without Harrell and you give the center minutes to Subach, Green, and I guess if you keep Noah around or some other third string center, like, fine. And then freeze up your four to more versatile lineup. Like, maybe you make Kawhi the full-time four. Maybe you bring Paul George up in that role just a little bit more. There are guys who can go in and play that four because, the four is a very fluid position these days. Mm-hmm. Like, do you really lose something?
They probably win this series if they don't get rid of Mo Harkless. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, that's. See, I would rather take Mo Harkless right now straight up over Marcus Morris. And they even threw in a first rounder.
I agree. Yeah. Fully agree.
So let's go to Marcus Morris then, because it sounds like you guys are pretty out on the Marcus Morris experiment with the Clippers.
To be fair, I was out when we you know how pissed off yeah. I was when they made that trade. I never liked him. I told you as much that when he was in New York, don't let the 20 points per game fool you. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they have his non-bird rights. He earned, it was 1 year, $15 million this year, so they can give him up to a starting salary of $18 million. I do not think the Clippers will be giving him that much money. I don't think any team is going to be giving him that much money. But is this a case where it's like veteran minimum or walk away?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think so, because this is a championship contending team that can pull that we need more money elsewhere card. Right. Anybody else, you can't. I don't think there's any chance you're getting Morris for the vet minimum. There's just no way. Like, if Denver called Marcus Morris right now, it's like, hey, vet minimum, want to come to Denver and come off the bench? Mm-hmm. He'd probably say no. But, like, in terms of the Clippers, in terms of a team of that caliber, in terms of the national narrative, which Denver still is not quite at that level, I think that you're talking vet minimum. I really do.
Yeah. It very well, or I mean, heck, you know, the Lakers might come and say, hey, come play with your brother, and then, you know, can
the 2 years, $10 million kind of a contract thing.
Yeah, or
I think he's gonna get more than the min, but I will say as much, I think it's you have to look at it as well as what can you get. Like, do you even want him on the team? I think the Clippers have reached that point now where they have to look at that roster and they have to go, okay, who do we trust? Who do we trust in a difficult playoff series moving forward? We certainly can't trust Marcus Morris because, you know, he is barking so much that he actually might get thrown out and suspended for a game. Like, for example, like, how did he not get suspended against Dallas? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. For what he did to Luka there, I still don't know. But when you have a guy of that caliber who barks as much as he does, is a black hole, doesn't move the ball, I think you have to ask yourself that question. Is it addition by subtraction if you don't keep him around? And can we just get a guy with the minimum who comes in and just works better within the fabric of the team? I mean, that's where we are. So for them specifically, yeah, it's probably a minimum. Where for other teams who just need talent, they might say, yeah, sure, why not $5 million a year?
Yeah, there's going to be the Knicks will offer him more money than he should get. That's unquestioned, I feel like, at this point.
Yeah, getting him back there, that's the perfect marriage for him.
It makes so much sense.
It's a loathsome franchise. He can come in and average 20 and just jack up shots. It's perfect.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, then they can flip him for a pick again. Maybe that's just it's like a Ponzi scheme.
They're just going to keep using him and just pass him around to make sure they can get extra picks.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, I asked Paul Millsap after Game 5 against the Clippers when they had the scuffle with Marcus mm-hmm. Morris and Paul Millsap. I was like, was there a moment there where you decided you were not going to be seen as a guy who was willing to be punked by this Clippers team? I phrased it a little bit more professional and saying punked, but that was the gist of it. And he basically said, yeah, like, we were not going to let them continually talk the way they were talking to us and attack us more physically in that way. So Paul Millsap made a point to stand up right then, and that was the infamous quote where he said, get ready to go home, or whatever it was. And from that point forward, Denver blew the doors off of the Clippers. So I really wonder how much that negatively impacted their team. And also, while we're talking about guys, like, how much value do they really bring? Can you really trust them? Patrick Beverley. This is very much so in the same vein. Like, he helps you in a lot of ways. He did not give them catch-and-shoot three-point shooting. He did not give them nearly enough defense, and he was yapping the entire time, and it didn't help. It didn't do anything but create more foul trouble and to throw the game into more disarray, and that's not helpful for a Clippers team that relies on their star powers to be in rhythm.
20 minutes a game, that series, for Pat Bill.
That's insane. And he probably, what, averaged 4.5 fouls per those 20 minutes, too.
So I have to ask this question, and I don't mean for it to be trolling, but, you know, Kawhi and Paul George can both become free agents next offseason. Was the Paul George trade a mistake for the Clippers?
I said no. Yes from... Oh, no?
I'm going to say no for this reason. Just hear me out. It gave them Kawhi. That's... if through that lens specifically... if that's what you kind of put it all up as, like that's the hinge of it all. You get Kawhi. That's fine because it's Kawhi Leonard. In a nutshell, in an isolation, Paul George? No, hell no.
Yeah, like would they be better off right now? I mean, I think you're right more. Like the Kawhi aspect of it, if Kawhi wasn't going to sign there without Paul George, then they had to do it for that reason, because Kawhi could have very easily signed with the Lakers instead, and that would have been an absolute disaster for the Clippers. So I get it from that point. But, you know, let's say Kawhi is fine signing there either way, which I don't...
Oh, yeah, then no chance in hell is it a good trade.
Let's even include Kawhi in this for a second, because this is my thing. It's the 2-year part of this contract, because we are literally half a season away from them starting slow and losing these guys on the trade market. Like, that's what we have to look at here. If this was more than 2 years guaranteed where you can just skip out halfway through the second, then yes, that makes total sense. You gave yourself a 1-year window and you put all your chips on the table. If you give yourself more than a year, then sure, I am all in on trying to do your best to win a title when you have the opportunity to do so. To give yourself 1 year to do that is not intelligent. That's not smart basketball creation there. So no, I don't think that was smart. I think it was a mistake because they didn't give themselves any room to grow and breathe to be able to create a winning team here.
I think that's reasonable. That's a reasonable take. Like, if Kawhi had signed for at least 3 to 4 years locked up without any options, then you could have looked at it as said, we have the long-term security with him, and you know he's not going to hold that over us for a whole year. And like next year, he could. I mean, this could realistically be the one and only season where they aren't necessarily afraid of losing him, whereas next year he's like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to stick around.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, you can easily compare them to the Nets with KD and Kyrie, both of whom who signed 3+1s instead of 2+1s.
That's my point.
Yeah.
3+1s makes so much more sense in this situation. Right. And the fact that they gave themselves literally this small of a window, it gave them no room for error. And when you give yourselves no room for error, when you send out 5 first round picks and 2 pick swaps and 2 near all-star level players, one of which you just drafted, you have to be right. You have to at least give yourself the time to prove that you can be right. And to give themselves 1 year, and I'm guarantee you, all ESPN will be talking about the second that these finals end is what happens to Kawhi. What happens to Paul George next year? What happens to Giannis next year? It is going to be the endless circulation of trade rumors, and I guarantee you that both Kawhi and Paul George are very interested in looking elsewhere as well. Because why wouldn't you see what else is out there? Why wouldn't you at least, you know, entertain the idea of it after what just happened to you in the playoffs?
Yeah,
I don't know. I think Kawhi is locked in. I think Kawhi would be looking at it through the lens of, oh, can we get PG out of town potentially? Like, can we upgrade this roster around me? Because like he,
what are you gonna trade to upgrade the roster? Like, you can trade PG, but like his contract is still gargantuan, so it's hard to get enough back for it, and you don't have any picks. You have none.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with you, but I'm saying that NBA players don't look at it that way. I'm saying that I think Kawhi is in it for the long haul. Ultimately, I think he's waiting so he can get up to that threshold and he'll sign a long-term deal, and that's it. I think because he loves LA, he made a big fuss about wanting to come back home, and there's not really any trade that I see that just makes sense, like for him to get to the Lakers at least. So I think he's in it. I think he's just wanting to mold this team after his preferences, and you know, this is him basically owning up to, oh, maybe Paul George shouldn't be the hill that I died on.
That's fair. That's very fair.
Can I interest them in a slightly used Al Horford?
Slightly use Al Horford. No Ben Simmons, though. That's too far.
Oh, but Joel Embiid, though.
Yeah. You know where I stand on that.
Yeah, God. I know you do.
Yeah. I love how this still turned into, wow, the 76ers are a disaster. Somehow always. This podcast still got always. That way back there.
Oh, yeah.
It has to. Well, I mean, you know, if they... I mean, that's ultimately the question, right? Like, for the Clippers, do you effectively... Like, if your big theory is that we didn't have chemistry, we came together this year, didn't have enough time, load management, whatever, we just need more time, do you run it back and just trust that next year will be better, or do you have to make substantive changes to this roster knowing that Kawhi and Paul George can leave?
I think you have to make decisions looking forward as well as right now. I think you have to at least be preparing for it. If you don't, you're going to fall into that Nets situation after they traded everything to go get Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce, and you're going to be stuck in just complete basketball limbo for the next 6 years. That cannot happen. They have to find some way. Being able to flip a couple, like, I would look to flip Zubats and see if you can find a more versatile center to play next to him. Find a shooter who can play off ball and can protect the rim a little bit. Like, things like that can impact this. Like, if they can go throw money at Brooke Lopez or go throw money at someone like that and try and get a guy like that, maybe you can find a way to make this work. But it's going to be very difficult. They don't have a lot of guys they can move. Like, maybe Landry Shamet gets you a first. Like, I don't know how that's going to work, but they need to change something because the current makeup of this team is not right, and it's not going to work long term, in my opinion.
Yeah, I got that question as late as just today regarding specifically Zubac and Shamet. Like, those are those are the two most attractive young trade pieces that they have. Mm. And, you know, the guy who asked me was like, they sort of have to, right? Yep. At this point, they have to. You know, Zubac's stock is growing because he's a really strong defender, and he's just a very smart basketball player, and he's, what, 22, 23 years old? Shamet, in the right system, could be one of the best three-point shooters in the damn league. So obviously there's going to be some value there, but at the same time, if you mortgage that future for the Clippers, you know, are you just digging yourself a hole that's even deeper than what you're in right now?
It's a fair question.
It's a scary question,
right? Because if look, they just they wasted assets on Marcus Morris. That was a mistake. So if they mess up with Zubac and Shamet and they find another Marcus Morris and that just completely unhinges everything, you're screwed.
Yeah.
This is a very bad spot for them to be in. I have no idea what they're going to do. And this is the thing. Like, what they're probably going to have to do is attach one of those first-round picks to get rid of Patrick Beverley's $13 million a year to open up some money. Like, they have to find a way to create cap space as well, because you can't just sign guys to mid-level, you know, to your exceptions and as vet minimums. You're not going to find enough talent there to build around this roster out. So they're probably going to have to trade one of Zubats or Shamet to get a first-round pick to pair with Beverley to send him elsewhere.
Don't be surprised if you hear rumblings surrounding a deal where the two components are a signed and trade Chris Dunn for Patrick Beverley. That would surprise me.
That's a really interesting one, actually. I like that. That would make a lot of sense for both sides.
Beverley was choosing between the Bulls and the Clippers last summer, and because he's a Chicago kid, and the Bulls are actively, they've wanted him for years. Now, obviously, I don't know if Karnišovas
I can say for a fact that Karnišovas does not like those types of point guards who are all grit, no, like, not a lot of skill. That's not his MO. So I can say that from a Nuggets perspective when I cover
him.
Well,
in that case, then that's dead. But I just, you know, that I wouldn't have been surprised otherwise then. But, I mean, if Karnišovas' vision is different, then... Yeah, by all means.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, bottom line is, TJ, I think you said it well, that, you know, this is going to be one of the prevailing storylines of the offseason. And, like, God forbid Giannis signs a Supermax, then it is all Clippers all the time.
Yep. Yep. I mean, and you're in LA, so you can't escape it. Like, you're going to be in the spotlight for the entire season for the wrong reasons. And for a guy like Kawhi Leonard who doesn't play and doesn't talk, that's going to be very difficult as an organization to manage that all of that narrative that is swirling. You won't have like LeBron coming out and being like, I'm not talking about my free agency until the season's over. Kawhi doesn't do that. So like, this is going to potentially spiral in a disastrous way for a team that has already shown that maybe they're not as mentally strong as we thought they were.
I'm very excited.
For once, it's not just the 76ers just like devolving into chaos. You can live in another Clippers realm where everything just sucks and it's falling apart, and it's not just you.
Please just distract from the ongoing disaster that's happening in Philadelphia. Thank you, Clippers.
Oh my god, this is such a sad thing.
I'll say this though, just to be fair. I feel bad for Kawhi. I know that he demanded Paul George and is thus indirectly responsible for the situation that they're in, but I love Kawhi. It would have been a great story if he'd won his third ring for a third club. Yeah. I mean, come on.
It's a better story that he should have stayed in Toronto in the first place. That's my take. None of this should have ever happened. That's what I love about this series, is that it was the Nuggets built from the ground up. Everything internal. We developed these guys, and the Clippers, who just bought like 12 dudes and threw them on a roster together. It's like, yep. To see that actually play out in a playoff series of this magnitude was very encouraging for the overall NBA scope and how to build a roster, because maybe for once it won't be that way, and maybe the guys will think about staying in smaller markets that aren't on ESPN 18 hours a day. Like, maybe that will actually start to shift, because there are enough smart front offices now that can create good teams that will actually be able to fit with a lot of these star players who are looking for that type of an environment, even though it's not in LA or New York. So I want that to happen for the NBA so badly, and I'm really hoping that maybe this series opened some eyes to a lot of these NBA players, but I don't think it actually did.
Yeah, to be fair, the Lakers bought their guys as well.
Yes, but also they were like from the – that's one thing that's interesting. Kawhi Leonard wasn't like going golfing with Paul George or fishing. LeBron James was calling AD being like, how you want to run the team? What you want to do? What we're going to get together? What are your kids up to? What school you need? Like, they were doing everything they could to make that work. I don't think they had that leadership. That comes down to Kawhi Leonard. So we'll see how that works out in the long term. I think Kawhi is as much as fault for this loss as anybody. Like, he was a black hole on offense himself in Game 7. He had so many opportunities to kick out to open shooters and just refused to do so. So there's a lot of this on Kawhi Leonard as well, despite the talk about his increased playmaking. So I don't know. I don't know if they have it.
I'm blaming Brian for that one, because before Game 7, Brian was like, he's going to take 39 shots and not look to distribute whatsoever. True. So I'm
Kawhi
blaming
Leonard's
Brian for
on
that
one. Listen to the NBA pod like, man, Brian's right. What am I been doing, man? I'm going to start jacking. Let's go.
But, I mean, he didn't. He, I don't know who brought this up. It might have been John Hollinger. I apologize if it wasn't him, but someone brought up, like, he didn't look necessarily physically right. Like, a lot of his shots, you know, I remember one floater in particular where, like, runs in the lane, and, like, that's automatic for him usually, and he left it wildly short. So I...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I can't help but wonder whether that knee was more of a problem than he was letting on, and, I mean, unfortunately, I think that's just going to be the Kawhi Leonard story for the rest of his career. You just always have to wonder, like, if he's not 2019 postseason Kawhi, like, is he at 100% or even close to 100%?
Did you get a chance to edit out my Michael Jordan comparison?
Nope, it's going to live until the end of time.
Damn it.
No, but to be fair, Denver is really, really, really good at sending help at strange times when defending. They don't send doubles when you see them coming. They don't hedge when you expect them to. They don't take the right angles that you expect them to. So there was a lot, like, I actually wrote about this after game one, that Denver did a really good job of being physical and mistiming everything they were doing on purpose to throw off the rhythm of that Clippers offense. So I do want to give Denver some credit there, because Kawhi Leonard was taking jumpers from like a foot further away than he expected off the wrong foot. Like, those are the small micro decisions that did make a difference in this series, and the Denver Nuggets had a lot to do with why they became.
Yeah, that's,
you know, I this is just hitting me. If Kawhi is to look elsewhere, you know what would be interesting? The Nuggets.
What about the Nuggets? What's interesting about the Nuggets?
Well, when you just think about him, you know, as a potential trade candidate, or him,
there's no way. There is no way.
No, no, no. But I mean, I'm just saying, like, from a strictly on court perspective, having, you know, a lesser responsibility with the ball in your hand, because you obviously there is Nikola Jokic, there's Jamal Murray, who will handle the vast majority of the on ball, you know, handle that responsibility. They'll initiate the offense. They can shoot. They can drive. They can do. They're so multifaceted that Kawhi would be in such a luxurious position that he can just pick and choose his spots whenever. That would be outstanding.
No, if Denver had Paul George, or sorry, if Denver had Kawhi Leonard at power four, they're going to win multiple titles. Like, that's how well he fits. There's just no way that I see Kawhi Leonard coming to Denver. And, like, I've tried to remove that from my... It's like the same thing with Giannis. Like, God, could you just imagine the idea of Giannis leaving Milwaukee and being like, Denver fits. Like, I could score so easily next to Nikola.
He's...
I would move to Dallas and just beg anybody to let me cover that team if that was the case, because Lord, Luka and Giannis would be fun together.
No, but, this is written in stone. I've been on that wagon for the past month and a half. I'm leading that bandwagon right now.
Wait, I've never heard of this. This is the first time I've even thought about this before. So I've literally not seen this.
Yeah,
that's because you have me muted on Twitter. Then
I get off of Twitter for your own sanity, guys. It's just doom scrolling, as my guy Mike Sykes call it, and I want no part of that.
That's fair. Yeah, Mort is trying to speak it into existence, like Voldemort did with Lonzo going number two.
Yeah,
I can't even start on my Lonzo takes, man. I got so many. I'll leave those where they are.
Yeah. So let's pivot away from the Clippers disaster. Let's go to another team that's a disaster. The Boston Celtics down 2-0 to the Miami Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals. After game two, there was some shouting and throwing of objects in the locker room, which Shams and Woj and just everyone has been reporting on. What? I mean, I can't even express my amount of surprise. Like, I thought this would be a close series. I thought it would probably go six either way. I don't think I would have expected the Heat to get up 2-0. And especially, I mean, the Heat have been out-executing the Celtics late in games, which you're just not used to seeing with a Brad Stevens team. So, TJ, what's caught your eye so far in these first two games from Boston's perspective?
Is that we've all underrated Miami. Every single one of us, and I'm included in this, I have massively underrated Miami. Not only do they have a killer on-ball offensive player in Jimmy Butler, who is also an elite defensive player, but they also have elite pick-and-roll play with Goran Dragic, which is just incredible. He's been at an all-star level. Dragic has been so, so good. And then, as your third pillar, as I believe it was... I can't remember who it was on the Zach Lowe podcast who called it the three pillars, but their third pillar is having Bam Adebayo at the high post. Like, they can score from anywhere. They can do anything on offense. And that was what was missing. No one's going to question their defensive ability with Bam Adebayo on the floor with Jimmy Butler. Nobody is going to question that combination of defensive just complete dominance. They are that good. And then when you combine that offensive versatility with it, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, I don't even know how you can beat this team. After they beat the Bucks in the way that they did, I trust this team. I really think the Heat are going to go to the finals. I had picked the Celtics as my dark horse if the Bucks didn't make it. I'm off that now. I was wrong. This Heat team is legit. And if Jimmy Butler's playing like this, it's over, man. Like, I can put a fork in this series. That's how I'm feeling right now.
I took a victory lap the other day because I've been saying for years that Jimmy Butler is a top 10 player. And, you know, I've gotten the usual feedback. Like, oh, he's not even top 30. He's a nutcase. Look at his points per game. You know, the typical points per game.
What I would argument. Say to you, for sure.
Right. And look, what he's doing right now is, it's just incredible. Because it's not just the facilitating and the defense. It's him understanding, you know, I don't need to assert myself when Goran Dragic has it going. Or when everyone else has it going. I don't need to be that guy. I can just sit back and I can do whatever, and if push comes to shove, then I'll drop 40. Like, that having that luxury and having that understanding of time and score and space and teammates and whatnot. I mean, you know, we talk about basketball savants and geniuses like, you know, Rajon Rondo and LeBron James all the time, but it takes a very, very high basketball IQ to understand the fabrics and inner workings of a team the way that Jimmy Butler does right now.
But it also requires him to be at the right place. And, like,
correct.
Anywhere else other than Miami where he could have ended up would have been a disaster potentially as well. Like, I will die on the hill that Denver getting Jimmy Butler would not have helped them. Like, that would have been a disaster in Denver. But in Miami, with that group of guys, with that front office, with that culture, with that coaching staff, there is nothing that fits better. And to get this is the other thing. Having a rookie like Tyler Hero who can take it, like, just take the crap that Jimmy Butler gives out, and to right. be able to become part of that, it removes all of the chaos that would have originally existed. Like, how many times has Jimmy Butler's biggest thing been like, I want to kill the guy I don't like that's young? That's always been his go-to. And now that he has this group of young dudes who are tough-minded, like really, really tough-minded, that has allowed him just to be himself unapologetically without having to create drama. And I don't think that exists very many other places for him outside of Miami.
No, I agree. I think it works there, and it would have worked alongside LeBron in LA, and that's pretty much it, I think.
Yeah, maybe. And even then, I think LeBron James and him probably would have come to fists a couple of times. Like, there's still a level there where, like, having those kinds of personalities around each other can become troublesome, but it's worked in Miami, man.
But I will say this, though. It's a shame on some level that it took him until his age 30 season for someone to realize, oh, hey, maybe it's a good idea to surround Jimmy Butler with shooters.
God, man. Don't even get me started on all of the teams with incredible players. Like the 76ers, who refuse to put a lot of shooters around either one of their incredibly paint-dominant players. Like, it just doesn't happen. I don't know why. And also, the other thing that Miami's done a great job of is being like, all right, late game, Jimmy Butler point guard. Let's go. Like, you're going to walk the ball up the court, and we're going to kill guys with your size over and over again. And if they double, you're smart enough to make the pass. Like, it's been really impressive seeing how much trust Spoelstra has in him. Coach Spo deserves all the flowers for how good he's been, man. Like, he has been one of the best coaches in basketball year after year after year without ever being talked about as such. And I really think he needs more love for what he's been doing.
Right.
Yeah. I would agree with that, too. So I guess, I mean, from Boston's perspective, it sounds like Gordon Hayward should be back for Game 3. You know, both Games 1 and 2 were both really close, right? Like, it's not like we're talking about, no offense here, Jim, it's not like Lakers-Nuggets Game 1 here. Where, you know, it both came down to late game execution, basically, and, you know, adding Gordon Hayward back to that mix. I don't think he'll be in there for late game possessions necessarily, but will bolster Boston's bench. So maybe, you know, in Game 2 where they had a double-digit lead, maybe they're more able to hold on to such a lead with another reliable scorer like Hayward. But Mort, I mean, he is coming off of a month, basically, you know, coming off the injury is a month of rust. Like, what are realistic expectations for Hayward moving forward in this series?
Just being a ball handler in that said, you can't trust a shot at this point. I think that would be premature, but you can trust him as a ball, as you know, as a ball mover, as a ball initiator, or an offensive initiator, and that's probably it. So he'll give you some ball handling, he'll give you some assists, maybe a few rebounds, maybe some spot up shooting if he's lucky, and that's it right now. But if he comes back and he's like the full Gordon Hayward right off the bat, that's a huge talent injection to Boston immediately, because they had to stretch their bench a lot. Like, they virtually had no bench in the second round of the playoffs because he was out. You know, they moved Marcus Smart into the starting lineup, and their top bench scorer, we talked about this on this podcast, was Brad Wanamaker at 5.7 points per game. So they really need for Marcus Smart to move back to the bench and become a two-way player from there, because right now they have very, very little production coming off the pine.
TJ, do you think he could be the difference for them in Game 3 and moving forward?
I think he can. I don't know if it'll be enough to overcome this Heat lead that they already have in the series, but whenever you can put a 6'8 smart defender who can do so many things offensively onto the floor, regardless of where he's at physically or in terms of his overall conditioning, if he's healthy enough to play, that is going to help. Like, there is just, like, I'm a big advocate that there are always guys who are going to feel like threats on the floor, even if they haven't played in a long time. And putting him out there is going to force the defense to at least think about him a little bit more. Having him out there instead of Marcus Smart as a shooter is going to change everything for their offense. The amount of room they're going to have to hit cutters down low and to actually run high pick and roll with more effectiveness is going to be huge. So I do think it'll shift things quite a bit. I still don't know if it's enough to overcome that Heat team.
Yeah. Do we think, I mean, I'm guessing he's not going to start, probably not the whole series, but definitely not right away, right? I mean, like, Marcus Smart has been playing so well that they've got to keep him in the starting lineup, right?
I have no idea how they're going to go about that, because they do need more, though. Because Marcus Smart has been great in his energy aspect of things, but they need more scoring-wise and to keep their offense from being so predictable. Watching that last Game 2 finish where they were just like, please, Jason Tatum, hit a pull-up three. Like, please, 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 please hit a pull-up three. Like, you just see how unbalanced the floor was for them. So I think that putting, even if he's not going to be wildly used, and you're going to pull him out at the 7 minute mark for Marcus Smart, like, that's fine. You need another threat on the floor to make some room for you to run some high pick and roll with Kemba and Tice and try and create some kind of collapsing defensive effect to kick to shooters. Because right now, that's not there. They're relying so much on isolation and pull up play that isn't going to be sustainable long term, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how this... I mean, this is probably the series right here. If Boston loses game three, you know, you're probably...
Oh, it is.
Yeah, you're not...
3-0 is very different than 3-1. Like, Denver, like, no one's coming back from that.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. It's going to be really interesting because, TJ, I think you're right. Like, no one realistically could have expected Miami to be in this position right now. But, you know, I think... defensively, they're just so locked in, and like it just feels like they have more confidence, which again, you maybe I'm just saying this because the Celtics have like burned a hole in my brain, but you know, in a late game situation, I always expect them to be the one that comes out ahead. But like the Heat are just playing with this swagger where it's like they know, you know, when they're down double digits late in the third quarter, early in the fourth quarter, it doesn't seem insurmountable. Like they just keep chipping away and like keep staying in the game, and it's like no lead is safe against this team, which is just, I would think, is kind of demoralizing if you from the Celtics' perspective.
Yeah, and big love for Duncan Robinson, who has just been an incredible three-point shooter all season long, and it's just an absolutely insane threat coming off any screen. Like, that's what gives them that also comeback effect, is they're not just gritty getting to the rim with a big and a guy like Jimmy Butler. You have Duncan Robinson and Tyler Hero who can light it up from any given point. That completely changes how you approach this team. They didn't have that before, that explosive scoring threat from beyond the arc. Jimmy Butler always had it going to the rim, but it's different now. The math has changed.
Yeah. What are your predictions for game three?
Yeah, I think it might actually be Miami. I kind of hope not. I want a long, entertaining series. So I'm actually rooting for Boston tonight, just so we get that long series. But if I'm asking my gut, it's probably Miami. It seems like they're in that rhythm, you know?
Yeah.
That rhythm. That whole championship or bust kind of thing. And at the same time, when I look at Boston and look at the Heat, going into the finals, you know, the team with the best chance of coming out with the whole trophy, it has to be Miami of those two, right? Regardless of who they meet in the West, like,
I would say yes to that question. I think so because they're the only team who can match up physically with the Lakers, and they're the only team that has a center who can match up with Nikola if they end up getting there. Like, Bam Adebayo is the difference maker here. Bam Adebayo is what makes all of this function at such an elite level on both ends of the floor. So yeah, I'm with you. I think it's Miami who has the best chance against a Western Conference team in the finals.
Yeah, I think so too. So I think ultimately it behooves us to have a good long ass series and then have them move into the finals against whoever.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
God.
I'm telling you, just give me Nuggets Heat finals. It would be so good. I just need this to happen. Oh, it'd be such good basketball.
How much is Dwayne Wade hating retiring a year too soon?
Do you think Dwayne Wade's playing on this team? They'd be like, okay, yeah, let's pull Duncan Robinson for Wade's three-point shooting.
No, but rings are
like
rings, man. Rings are rings.
Yeah,
rings are rings, and it's always nice to have an extra one on your finger than you did, but man, I don't know.
He would be the guard of Udonis Haslam's. He would just be like the assistant coach. On the bench,
could
being played like a player.
You imagine them having both of them doing absolutely nothing but just hanging out for moral support? That would actually be really funny.
Well, apparently, I mean, UD apparently has given Jimmy some pep talks during these playoffs that were like, I forget which series it was, but you know, he was. I think it was the Bucks series, right? Where like UD went up to Jimmy and was like, "Don't you let us lose this game?" And then Jimmy's like, "Oh, okay," and then took over.
No big deal. All it takes is the magical words of Udonis Haslam to change the complete complexion of an NBA playoff game. I love it. I love Udonis Haslam, man. The NBA needs to expand one roster spot more to give a player coach again. I need that to happen. Like, Mike Miller needs to come back to Denver from Memphis. Like, I need this to happen.
Oh, totally. Well, that is a good place for us to wrap up, guys. So, TJ, thank you again for coming on. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, Rocky Mountain Hoops Podcast, anywhere you listen to podcasts, and then at TJ McBride NBA for all of my late night insanity.
Yeah, please give TJ a follow, unless you're a Lakers fan, in which case his
hey, I grew up a Lakers fan. Everyone keeps thinking I'm a Nuggets fan. It cracks me up. I grew up a Lakers fan, so this is hysterical.
Yeah, I was actually about to ask you that question at the top of the show. I just forgot. Like, you had to be in an emotional pickle right now.
No, because, like, when you cover the league for long enough, you kind of lose the rooting interest. So, like, I really don't have anybody that I'm rooting for. Like, I'm rooting for a good series. Yeah, so, like, yeah. I'm really of the analytical mindset of basketball now, not rooting anymore.
I know the feeling. I did when I quit the Bulls, I actually found myself enjoying the league as a whole so much more. So yep. I am definitely not going back to like one team.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Well, on that note, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we are being hosted by Spreaker. So check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. I'm Brian Sporek, and until next time, I was joined by TJ McBride and Morten Jensen. Gentlemen, enjoy these next few games of the West, both conference finals. And TJ, I would say best of luck, but really, now I'm just going to hope that the Nuggets get down 3-1 so we get a 7-game series.
Amen to that, man. Michael Malone petitioned for the league to start them down 3-1, he said. So who knows? Maybe we'll get there anyway.
I saw Matt Moore ask him that question, and it just made me love Matt Moore that much more.
God, I love that guy.
All right. Later, guys.
Have a good one.